did as he was told. But the potion had been put there by Vaspis, and it was a love potion. Whoever drank it would fall for the first person they saw. Then who should turn up, guided there by Vaspis's trickery? Meshuk. Meshuk, the stone mother, fat old Meshuk with skin of rock and lava in her belly and great big boobs right out to here. He was still miming their enormous size when he became aware that Fenn was looking at him with the kind of mild disgust generally reserved for garden vermin. He coughed and scratched his jaw. Anyway, Joha fell for her on the spot and they went at it. Meshuk got with child, and when the time came, she had two of them. One was pale and fair. The other was like her ma, cold outside and fiery inside, full of rage. Well, Joha, he loved the first, but not the second. And Meshuk's a cruel, hard mother who don't care much for her children. Joha tried to convince Fair Lissa to live with him by Joha's river. That's that big, bright smear up there near the hangman. But Lissa wouldn't abandon her sister, and she said no. See, nobody could take care of Tantera but her. Nobody else could keep her sister's fury in check. Joha was impressed by his daughter's kindness, so he set them both in the sky together, between the stars and the earth. And every night, Lissa goes chasing after Tantera, who's always trying to slip her sister's watch. On the nights Tantera escapes, when Lissa's not around, that's when it's a blood moon night. Then Tantera gets up to her mischief, and the spirits come out to play, and it's ill fortune all round.
"Certainly turned out to be ill fortune for Vala," said Fenn. "And Tarvi, and Otten, and Dox."
Cade sobered as he remembered Fenn's dead companions and the terror of the Dreadknight's first assault.
"Reckon it did at that," he said. He glanced at her, but she didn't seem sad, only indifferent.
"Anyway," he went on, seeking to lighten the conversation, "even if Joha only loved one and not the other, the sea knows his daughters. That's why it strains towards the moons whenever they pass over. And, that's the story of the sisters," he finished, somewhat lamely. There was silence between them for a time, before Fenn said,
"Joha's a real bastard sometimes, isn't he? Turning his back on his daughter like that."
Cade had never really thought about it, but she had a point.
"Reckon you're right. Gods don't make the greatest role models."
They went quiet again, but Cade fancied the silence was more companionable than before. The lake water sloshed against the wall beneath their feet, while he studied the piled walkways and wings of Skavengard, its bridges and spires, the outbuildings that clung like limpets to the vertical rock. After a time, he became uncomfortable and looked away. He had a growing sense that Skavengard was watching him, rather than the other way around.
"Were you at Salt Fork?" he asked.
Fenn stirred next to him, as if she'd forgotten he was there.
"We all were."
"What happened?"
Fenn considered her answer for a long time.
"We tried to make a difference," she said.
"We failed."
Cade frowned.
"Not much of a storyteller, are you?"
"Never had much opportunity to practice."
"Well, you start by adding in a few details. Was there a battle, treachery and betrayal, that sort of thing?"
50 of us went to Salt Fork to start something. 8 of us got out. Now there's 4. What else is there to say?"
Cade was disappointed. She wasn't a very forthcoming sort. He supposed that was one of the downsides of being mysterious.
"But you are with the Greycloaks."
"There's no such thing as the Greycloaks," she said bitterly.
"Of course there is. Not everyone's willing to put up with things the way they are. Who's fighting back against the Crodans if not the Greycloaks?"
"Scattered groups like us. Too small to do much good. Some of them claim they're with the Greycloaks, but they're just using the name. If there was any great resistance movement, we'd know by now. But this secret underground network you've heard of, these freedom fighters battling the Crodans on your behalf, they don't exist. The Greycloaks are a folktale."
"Well, can't you all team up or something?"
She gave him a tired look.
"People have tried. Sooner or later, someone sells them out.
The Iron Hand had Ossians betraying their own kind right from the start. Faint anger flickered across her face. The more people you trust, the more you're asking to let you down. The idea shocked and saddened Cade. The squareheads have a saying, tie two Ossians to a cart and they'll pull in different directions. Never believed it before now. Time to start, Fenn said. He examined his reflection in the water. Is Garrett going to kill us? She snorted. You think he'd go to all this trouble to rescue you if he was? Did you rescue us? Or did you capture us? Because I gotta say, it ain't exactly clear. Well, seeing as you were about to die at the hands of the Crodans, I'd say you were rescued, she said. We came for Aaron. Garrick wanted to get him out of the camp and take him somewhere safe. Apparently that's the limit of his obligation, though, so the first time we find, you're on your own. Assuming your friend makes it that far. But Garrick acts like he hates us. Aaron especially. Maybe he does. So why rescue him? I don't know. You'll have to ask Garrick. Cade made a strangled noise of frustration. You came all the way to the middle of nowhere to pull Aaron out of a Croden camp, and you don't know why. We regrouped after Salt Fork, made plans for what to do next. Then Garrick got some news and the plans changed. He said there was a boy called Aaron of Shoal Point in a camp at Sullers Bluff, and we had to make a detour to break him out. We asked why, of course we did. And? He said it was a debt of honour. Wouldn't say who he owed it to. Wouldn't say why. Said he'd do it alone if he had to. I guess Garrick's not much of a storyteller either. A debt to Aaron's father? Cade guessed. But Randall said the Hollow Garrick would kill him. I don't know anything about that. But we all owe Garrick enough that there wasn't much question of saying no. Once we were sure Aaron was in there, we made a plan to strike from the forest while the guards were marching you up to the mine. They weren't real soldiers. They would have run for a sign of trouble. The prisoners would likely make a break for it, and the Crodans would have been too busy hunting all those runaway Ossians to notice one missing. But we got wind the Hollow Man was looking for us, and we broke out first, said Cade, as it started to make sense in his head. He harrumphed. Reckon we needn't have bothered since you were going to break us out anyway. No, it was lucky you did, said Fenn. We had no idea there were dreadnoughts around. If you hadn't slipped their notice and got away, they'd have been on us much faster, and it would have been eight of us dead instead of four. She raised her eyes to his briefly. Don't listen to Garrick. Wasn't your friend's fault Vala and the others died? If anything, it's down to you that we survived. Cade glowed at that. Even if he didn't fully understand the situation, it definitely sounded like a compliment. So what's the plan now? What plan? You said you made a new plan after Salt Fork. We were just a detour. Where were you going originally? He jabbed a finger at her. And don't say you don't know. I know, she said. I'm just not going to tell you. Cade threw up his hands and swore. Why not? If I told you the plan and Garrick found out, he might change his mind about leaving you safe in a town and leave you dead in a ditch instead. What you don't know, you can't tell the Crodans.
I'd never tell the Crodans, Cade protested.
That's what they all say, until they do.
But you are on a mission, though, Cade asked slyly. The thought excited him.
Something secret, something important.
We were, she said. That was before. Now, I'm not sure.
Another half answer.
I'm sick of being left in the dark, he complained.
We're all in the dark, she said. Get used to it.
Cade tried a new tack. Tell me about yourself, then, he said brightly, and slapped his knees. Where are you from?
Does it matter? She asked.
Then she swung her leg over the wall and walked away towards the boathouse, without so much as a goodbye. He studied the water, disappointed. He'd been ripped from his hometown, worked near to death,
rescued by strangers and pursued with inexplicable determination by Crodan dreadknights. All his life he'd been tossed on the tides of fate, letting others make his choices for him. That was the way things were, it had seemed. Foolish for a carpenter's son to expect anything more from life. But everything was different now. That carpenter's son from Shoal Point had seen things, survived things. In breaking out of that prison, he'd climbed walls in his mind that he hadn't known were there. It had always been Aaron who called the shots, Aaron who looked out for him. Rich, educated Aaron, the highborn boy. But it was Aaron who needed looking out for now, and there was no one but Cade to do it. He needed to know what they were mixed up in. And if Fenn wouldn't tell him, well, he'd have to find out for himself. Dawn was just touching the sky when he climbed down off the wall and headed back towards the fire. It was a new day, and with it Cade felt an unfamiliar sense of purpose. The future was full of wild possibilities for the first time in his life. As he climbed the stairs to the chamber where the others slept, he felt happier than he'd been in months. He entered the room, and his heart froze in his chest. The others were awake, and gathered round Aaron's still form, wearing grave expressions. The druidess had her ear pressed to his naked chest, her face paint smeared with sleep, and her eyes closed in concentration, while her hound sniffed at him cautiously. He let out a cry and ran over to them. "What happened?" Suddenly his momentary happiness felt selfish and disloyal. How could he think of the future while his friend was still in mortal danger? "Easy, lad," said Osman, reaching out to calm him. But he knocked the hand away angrily. "Is he all right?" Cade demanded of the druidess. She didn't reply, just stayed there with her eyes closed and her head against Aaron's ribs. "Is he all right?" he shouted. She opened her eyes slowly, sat back on her haunches and looked up at him, serene. Then she smiled, and Ruck barked happily. "The worst has passed," she said. "Do not fear for your friend. He will live." Relief flooded through Cade, a rush so strong that it made his knees weak. "You're sure?" "I am. Another day of rest will see him back on his feet." She tried to stand and needed Keel's help to do it. An unstoppable, silly grin spread across Cade's face. He looked around for someone to share the joy that threatened to burst out of him, found only Osman, and hugged him impulsively. Osman chuckled and hugged him back. "Sorry about your hand," said Cade afterwards, miming a swipe. Osman waved his apology off. "I'm just glad the lad will make it."
"Lucky for you that he will," said Garrick, glaring at Cade and Grubb. "Grubb was born lucky," said Grubb, which Cade thought unlikely considering his face. "My thanks, druidess," Garrick said. "I owe you a greater debt than you know."
"If you want to thank me, you can start calling me by my name," she snapped. Keel handed Vika her staff, and she limped tiredly back to her blankets. Cade noticed she was dragging one foot, and one arm hung loosely at her side. "And get more wood for this fire."
"Vika, then," said Garrick with a nod. "If it's wood you want, I'll fetch it myself."
"Is she all right? What's up with her leg?" Cade asked Keel.
"Joe her only knows," said Keel, frowning. "She's been half lame since she woke up. Doesn't seem much surprised by it, though." He shrugged. "She's a druidess," he said, as if that explained it.
Cade gave up trying to understand and plonked himself down next to Aaron, where Ruck had also settled herself, as if watching over him. He scratched her under the chin, his eyes on his friend. Aaron's pallor had all but faded, and there was blood in his cheeks again. "I'll never leave you behind," he'd said to Cade once, and he was true to that, as he was true to all his promises. He was going to live. He was going to stay. "Never doubted you for a minute," he told Aaron. Ruck barked at him disapprovingly. She knew a lie when she heard one. 35. After the sun was up, the Hollow Man decided to scout the valley. No sense going through Skavengard if they could go around. Grubb volunteered to row the boat, which surprised everybody.
"Grubb strong,"
he said, with a grin that was meant to be ingratiating but ended up horrific.
"Grubb make himself useful."
The Hollow Man gave Grubb a look that oozed suspicion and distaste, but Grubb kept grinning until he waved his assent.
"Fen, Keel, you come too. Osman, keep an eye on the boy."
"You mean Aaron?" Moustache said pointedly. "He has a name." Grubb was pleased with that. Even Hollow Man's own people didn't like the way he treated Mudslug.
"You know who I mean," replied the Hollow Man dangerously.
Painted Lady was mixing up a paste to smear on Mudslug's chest and back to warm him. She was making a messy job of it. It wasn't easy with one working hand, but she'd refused any help. She reminded Grubb of the blood witches back home, who filed their teeth to sharp points and huddled by the fireside in their furs, casting the bones of babies that had died in the womb. She was strange and not a little frightening, but even Hollow Man respected her after what she did at the gate. Mudslug was still asleep, but he was in good hands, and Grubb was glad of that. He wouldn't want to see Mudslug die. Not yet, anyway. He might still be useful. They took the stairs down to the lake. The Bitterbracker examined the boat that rested in the cradle there and seemed impressed, so they lifted it and carried it to the water, where it bobbed among the remains of other inferior boats.
"Doesn't even leak after all this time," said the Bitterbracker. "What we'd have given for a craft like this in our seafaring days, eh, Garrick?"
Grubb made a show of examining it too, humming and hawing his agreement, but in truth he saw nothing to get excited about. It was just a boat. Once they were on the water, the eerie quiet closed in. The only sound was the splashing of Grubb's oars, the squeak of the rowlocks and the lapping of water against wood. The lake was a murky green. Great patches of weed floated on the surface, and it smelled faintly of rot. The islands of Skavengard reared above them, cliffs of grey stone, which were eventually consumed by the lower reaches of the castle. The valley walls to either side were bleak and lifeless, rising to jagged snowy peaks, with tatters of cloud clinging to them, like wind-blown rags caught on a fence.
"The spine of the Ostenburgs," said Freckles, looking up at them. "This valley cuts through the worst of it."
"Can they cross it?" asked the Hollow Man. "Will they be waiting for us on the other side?"
"I wouldn't like to guess what a dreadnought can do, but the passes will be snowed under by now, and it will take them several days at least. If the way out of Skavengard is as well hidden as the way in, I don't give much for their chances of finding it. I think they're behind us for now."
"Mountains in Skarathun higher than this," Grubb put in. "Skarls cross them all the time." "Is that so?" sneered the Hollow Man. "Seems every Skarl I ever knew spent half their time boasting about their homeland. Shame so few of you stay there."
"Skarls free spirits," Grubb said with forced good humour.
"Aye," said the Hollow Man, "and I never met one who wouldn't stab you in the back soon as it afforded them advantage."
"Oh, Grubb not that way," he protested. "Grubb want to help excessively angry man."
The Bitterbracker coughed back a chuckle, and the Hollow Man scowled.
"Just row," he said.
Grubb's smile faded as soon as no one was looking, and the loathing in his heart bled out onto his face. Let them treat him like a cur. It was no more than he was used to. The only account of him that mattered was the one made when he died, when the bone god spread out his skin and read upon it the deeds of his life. Then all these humiliations would be as nothing. But Grubb had half a body to cover before he dared let the bone god lay eyes on him, and for that he needed these people, whether they liked him or not. Half a body to atone for the other half. He tipped his head back to look up at Skavengard, its doleful spires reaching towards the sky. He sensed fear and wariness in the others, and that excited him. There were stories within, dangers to face, deeds to be done. That was good. He needed more tales of valour and craft, more victories to bring back to the sombre men, so that the skin scribes might mark them on his body. Breaking out of the camp at Sulla's Bluff had been a good start. Escaping the Dreadknights had been better, but he had a long, long way to go yet. "There's a wharf," said Freckles. At the foot of the nearest and smallest island was an inlet where a stone landing had been built, studded with mooring posts. "A door, too." She narrowed her eyes and peered closer. "I think it's ajar."
"If we put in there, we'll have to make our way through the whole length of the castle," said Garrick. "Keep looking."
Grubb rowed them further out into the lake, until the huge central island loomed above them. A thousand dark windows looked down on them from the clutter of buildings and walkways and domes. Strange skeletal structures, like scaffolds of bone, bulged from its sides. In all the immensity of Skavengard, nothing moved. There was no further landing spot, and the sheer cliffs made for an impossible climb for anyone but Grubb, so he rowed on. No one spoke, as if reluctant to disturb the uncanny peace. Soon, the rhythm of the oars lulled him, and he began to daydream of better times. The cold, crisp air and snow-capped mountains brought to mind summer in Skarathun, and those brief, precious months when he hadn't been a cur, when no one had thought him wretched. He had a different name then, and the skalds had sung of his deeds, and all of Skarathun had lifted their drinking tusks in his honour. As they toasted him, Grubb had allowed himself to believe that no one would ever sneer at him again, or despise him, or kick him like a dog. In that, he'd been sorely mistaken. He came from the slums of Karaka, somewhere amid the maze of crumbling tunnels and chambers that surrounded the greatest necropolis of the north. There he was conceived in a dirty wrestle in the corner of a crowded sleeping hall, between a man he'd never know and a mother he could scarcely remember. All his recollections of her were yearning and desperate. He was forever pawing at her leg, clamouring for her breast, cowering from her. He couldn't see her face in his mind. She was a shadow to him, ever looming in fury or turning away in disgust. Sometimes, when he was very young, he'd find her in a stupor, and he'd cry and push at her, afraid she'd never wake. Sometimes he had to pretend to be asleep, shivering in the chill, while she grunted and hunched beneath a blanket and a strange man. Other times she disappeared for days on end, and he was forced to forage for food among the sleeping families, or wander the tunnels looking for her. The last time she disappeared, she never came back. Strangers came instead, and took him away to a grim dwelling in the city. His mother had struck and killed a man while drunk, they told him. She'd been hanged for it. He was 6 years old. Things scarcely improved after that. His mother's tribe saw that he had a place to sleep and enough food to survive, but that was as far as their obligation went. Life in the orphanage was brutal, and neither the master nor the other children had any mercy for the newcomer. There was something in his manner that set people against him, and he suffered for it. The city was his saviour. Now that he was out of the slums, he had access to the boulevards and tunnels of the necropolis proper. He haunted the undermarkets, where the furriers hawked their wares, and the air was thick with the smell of fried spiced blubber. He went to the pens, where the hardy nomads of the ice plains traded livestock with the city folk, while enormous shaggy varanth shook their great horned heads and snorted steam into the air. He sneaked into the long halls, where men and women feasted by the fire pits, swigging brown ale from drinking tusks, while dogs ran about their feet. He begged food when he could, stole it when he dared, but mostly he just stood about and warmed himself, and listened to the skulls sing tales of heroes. Sometimes those very heroes were present to hear them. They sat at the best tables, their bodies dense with tattoos, and drank together while young skulls edged close, hoping one day to be as glorious.
When the weather wasn't too cold, he went up to the surface, where the tombs of his ancestors reared high above him, carved from black stone. In the distance, made blurred and dark by frost haze, a colossal statue of Balik the Sunderer stood astride a splintered peak, holding aloft the god-axe, Magoth, with which he'd made the mountains and the seas. Grub would walk the snowy streets and read deeds of legend carved on the tombs by the stone singers, and he'd dream. In time, he made a friend, a boy who'd noticed him often at the undermarket, and who spotted him taking fruit from a stall. That boy brought him back to a chamber where he lived among a dozen other boys, beneath the watchful eye of a crook-backed old man called Nook. Grub was welcomed and treated as a brother. He never returned to the orphanage after that. Nook recognized Grub's talent for theft and nurtured it. He was particularly skilled at climbing, despite his clumsy appearance. No wall or gate seemed beyond him. Though he was still beaten from time to time, as all children were, he was eager to please, and he pleased his new master well. But theft was a dangerous game in Karaka. The narrow tunnels and underground chambers left few places to run and hide, and thieves were especially reviled among Skarls. Ever since Thal Iqbar united the tribes, it had been all Skarls together against the world, for they were a people small in number and living in a hostile land. Foreigners could be swindled or killed without conscience, but to harm or betray a fellow Skarl, even to lie to them, was a terrible crime, and punishment was swift and pitiless. One by one, Grub's brothers were caught and hanged. Soon enough, his master Nook was hanged too. Grub fled the city, knowing the grave guards would be coming for him next. He made his way to the harbour, where the grey sea lapped against the shore. It was early autumn, but the waters hadn't yet iced over. With no other choice, he approached a captain and claimed his right of passage as a firstborn embarking on the Scattering. The captain couldn't refuse him. He sailed away from his homeland that day, a young man with his body hardly marked but for a few identifying details inked on his left cheek in the geometric runes of Tomb Tongue. He returned 15 years later, with half his body covered. How things were different then. How they celebrated their returning hero. How the women wanted him. He sat at the best tables in the long halls, and nobody dared to beat him, despise him, dismiss him any more. For a few months, he was loved. And then it was over. "Hold here," said the hollow man. Grub stopped rowing and let the boat drift. "There's our way out," said the Bitterbracker, pointing. Ahead, a bridge, supported by slender white arches, reached across the lake high above them. It extended from a towering building on the edge of the third island, and ended at a gatehouse in the valley wall.
"Aye," said Garrick, "but I've yet to see any place to land except that one wharf. Nowhere to climb, either."
"Maybe on the other side?" the Bitterbracker suggested.
"Maybe,"
said the hollow man, but he didn't sound hopeful. While they talked, Grub leaned over the side of the boat and looked into the water. Reflected back at him was a face he'd known all his life. Broad, squashed and toad-like, his shaved head turning dark with stubble. But the black band across his eyes hadn't always been there. That swiped crescent, running from cheek to cheek, drawn in a burning arc by the palm of a skin scribe while he screamed and begged for mercy. The sign of his disgrace. The mark of the outcast, hated by his people, spurned by the bone god himself. He looked away, up to the spires of Skavengard. It was a hard journey to forgiveness. He didn't know if it would ever be possible. But he'd started, and there was some victory in that.
"Take us round the island," the hollow man said.
Grub laid his hands on the oars and put his back into it. 36. Cade watched from an upper window as the boat returned, studying its occupants closely, as if careful observation might answer the question that now obsessed him. Who are you people? His conversation with Fenn had changed his rescuers in his eyes. No longer were he and Aaron in the company of dangerous rogues who might harm them. They were rebels, and that excited him. Even surly and hateful Garrick was somewhat redeemed by it. He was their leader, after all, and one held in great respect, even if Cade couldn't forgive him for the way he treated Aaron. After the others had gone scouting, Cade quizzed Osman, hoping to pry some information from him. But he wasn't as clever with people as Aaron, and Osman proved even less forthcoming than Fenn, if considerably more polite. "I'm afraid our business is our own," he said. "If you want to know more, it's Garrick you should ask." Cade snorted. "He's more likely to give me the back of his fist than an answer." "Then I would keep my peace if I were you." He returned to Aaron, who lay sleeping next to Ruck. It was cold enough that they needed a fire even in daylight. Vika sat a short distance away, staring into the flames while she reapplied the paint on her face. "Is he..." Cade began. "He is well," she said, "as he was the last 5 times you asked. Do not fret, Cade. He will wake when he's ready." It was kindly spoken, but Cade felt foolish anyway. The red-eyed child had walked close alongside them these last 2 nights, but she'd walked closest of all to Aaron. He was only just getting used to the thought that she was going to spare him. "What news?" Osman asked as the scouts made their way back to the fire.
"There's no way around," said Fenn. "We found a few wharves on the north side, but one's buried under rubble and the other is shut fast. The nearest entrance is open, though."
"We still have plenty of daylight," Garrick said. "Eat, all of you. Then we'll go over there and take a look around inside. Vika, will you stay with the boy?"
"I will."
"Good. Osman, you're coming too."
"And me," said Cade, thrusting a hand in the air. Garrick turned a stony glare on him, and his arm wilted uncertainly.
"I'll watch out for him," said Osman. Cade gave his best grin, showing all his teeth, which had the unintended effect of making him seem harmlessly moronic.
"So be it," said Garrick. "It's your neck. Make ready, then."
Cade scampered over to Aaron. Ruck stirred briefly, opened an eye, then closed it again.
"I'll be back before you know it," Cade said.
Then he leaned closer and dropped his voice so only Aaron could hear.
"I'm going to find out who we're dealing with. Leave it to me."
Ruck twitched an ear, and Vika, still applying the finishing touches to her face, smiled to herself. They sat round the fire to eat. They'd topped up their packs from the wayfarer's hut and taken extra packs for Aaron, Cade and Grubb, but even so Fenn insisted they ration carefully.
"There's nothing to hunt here, not even birds," she said, "and we can't resupply till we've crossed the mountains."
"If my belt gets any tighter, it'll cut me in half," Keel complained.
"Oh, stop it," said Osman. "It's not 3 days since we were eating rabbit outside Sulla's Bluff."
"Really?"
Keel chewed a piece of dried meat thoughtfully. "Feels longer."
"One time, Grab walk for 3 days without food."
"Didn't you eat a whole wheel of cheese back at the hut?" Fenn said acidly.
"Ha! One time, Grab ate 5 cheeses. He only stopped when cheese oozed from his ears."
Cade spluttered.
"I thought Skarls weren't allowed to lie."
Garrick gave a derisive laugh.
"Who told you that?"
"Aaron did," he said uncertainly. "He learned it in school."
"Always said school was a waste of time,"
Keel replied, biting off a piece of bread.
"Skarls aren't allowed to lie to each other," Osman explained. "It doesn't apply to foreigners. In fact, there's a saying,
when you speak with a Skarl, don't forget your shovel," Keel quoted happily, still chewing.
"What for?" Cade asked, mystified.
"To clear away the dung that comes out of their mouths," Keel said, and he and Garrick roared with laughter,
until Keel began to choke on his bread. Cade's eyes went wide with understanding.
You know, that explains a lot.
Hello? Grub sitting right here?
It was late morning when they rode across to Skavengard, leaving Aaron, Vicar, and Ruck behind. The Druidess warned them to be back before sunset. Paula spoke of a terror that came with the night, she said.
Seems empty enough, said Keel.
So it does, Vicar replied. But I do not trust that place, even in daylight. Keep your wits about you.
Grub rowed them to the stone landing where Keel moored the boat with a seafarer's knot. There was another boat moored alongside, smaller and lighter. It had capsized but was still afloat and looked intact.
Pollers? Fenn suggested.
Maybe, said Garrick.
Before them was a copper door, green with verdigris, and studded with black metal nails. It hung invitingly ajar. The stonework round the outside crawled with carved beasts and figures eroded into smooth lumps by the rain. Cade eyed them uncertainly, and put his hand on the hilt of the sword he'd borrowed from Aaron. He thought about drawing it, but nobody else had drawn theirs, so he left it where it was.
No sense pulling steel unless you mean to use it, said Keel, who'd noticed his indecision. Swords get damned heavy after a while.
Cade nodded in a stout fashion, as if from one warrior to another. Keel looked away, suppressing a smile.
Do not fear, said Osman. I've heard many tales of haunted places, but superstition is all they are. I've still to see anything with my own eyes that I couldn't explain. Aye, well, you're young yet, said Garrick, and pushed the door.
It swung open, lightly and without a sound, at his touch, as if partly propelled by its own will, like it was eager to let them inside. Dust stirred in the displaced air, blowing across flagstone floors. They stepped into a high-ceilinged chamber, lit by a narrow window above the entrance, that cast a blade of daylight into the room. There was no furniture, no tapestries, nothing but blank walls and emptiness. Silence settled around them like a damp fog, and with it a vague and sourceless unease.
"It's just an old abandoned place," Kay told himself. "Just stone and dust and stories, nothing more."
But he couldn't quite make himself believe it. They passed through a small antechamber before coming to the foot of a spiral staircase with light spilling down through its hollow centre. At the top of the stairs they emerged into a long corridor, ribbed and spined like the fossilized insides of some great serpent. A dozen or more doors could be seen along its length, and other corridors led off it, deeper into the island's interior. They listened and heard nothing but the scrape of their own boots, the chink of buckles, and the creak of their leather armor as they shifted about.
"Bear up and take a look around," said Garrick. "Don't go too far, and be back here by midday. If you find anything odd, call out. Joha knows we'll have no trouble hearing you."
"You're with me, Cade," said Osman. Cade opened his mouth and shut it again, disappointed. He'd hoped Garrick would pick him, frightening as that thought was. He wanted to get him alone, to winkle out whatever secrets he had. But Garrick and Keel, by unspoken assumption, were going together.
"Grub go with Freckles," Grub announced happily.
"What did you call me?"
Fenn said, in a tone that could have iced the lake. Keel burst out laughing, but the sound echoed strangely in the silence, and he abruptly stopped.
"Should have left him behind when we had the chance," Fenn muttered as she walked away.
"Take care,"
Keel called after her, then, under his breath, "Freckles." Fenn's anatomically improbable reply was graphic enough to make Cade blush, but it just made Keel grin all the wider. Grub trotted after Fenn, humming discordantly to himself. Garrick and Keel went the other way. Osman headed through an open doorway opposite the stairwell, leaving Cade casting regretful glances in Fenn's direction. After their encounter on the wharf, he found himself picturing her face whenever his thoughts were idle, and had developed a puppyish urge to please her. If he couldn't pair up with Garrick, He might at least have gone with her, but he was denied even that. With a sigh, he followed Osman. The ceiling here was lower than the corridor, held up by a dozen narrow pillars in a double row, each one carved with intricate script. Several large windows looked out onto the valley. At either end, the room was divided by a partition wall and a scalloped doorway. There was no clue as to what the room was used for, but Cade imagined robed figures drifting about it, doing whatever courtly things old Ossians did. "You're highborn, aren't you?" he asked Osman. "I am," said Osman. "Whatever that means in this day and age. A highborn Ossian is still lower than the meanest Croden peasant when it comes to it." "Is that why you joined Garrick?" "I wasn't yet born when the Crodens came," he said. "My grandfather was the head of the family, and he, like many others, submitted to save his own. But my father was a man of fierce conviction, and he held to the old ways. He never forgave my grandfather, not even on his deathbed." As he talked, he headed across the chamber to investigate one of the doorways. He peered inside, then went through. "When my father inherited our lands, he already had a reputation for criticizing the empire," Osman went on, studying whatever he saw beyond the partition wall. "My brothers had taken to Croden ways and begged him to keep his opinions to himself for the good of us all. But my father was proud. He hated what had become of Ossia, and was full of anger at what we had lost." His voice became sorrowful. "The Iron Hand heard of his sedition and took our lands away. My grandfather had powerful friends, but not even they could save my father from the gallows. My brothers disowned him in exchange for modest lives as clerks and scribes, and we do not speak any more." He sighed. "As to me, I left the day my father died. He had friends, too, of a more rebellious mind, and they had connections. I went to them and told them I wanted to join the fight against the Crodens. Once they were convinced, they set me on my path to Garrick, and Salt Fork, and so to here." As he emerged from the doorway, he was shaking his head, and he gave a little laugh. "But perhaps that is a longer answer than you hoped for. We all have our stories, I suppose, and—" He stopped as he realized he was talking to an empty room. "Cade?" Cade heard his name being called, but he was already well away, having nipped out into the corridor the moment Osman's back was turned. Now he followed the echo of voices through empty rooms on the trail of Garrick and Keel. "Pless is a maze!" It was Keel in the room ahead. Cade crept closer. "You saw it from the lake. Buildings piled on buildings, hanging over cliffs, pillared courtyards open to the drop. It must have been dreamed up by a madman, eh?"
"We'll keep the lake in sight and stay on the south side. Wouldn't take us half a day in a straight line."
"If we can find a straight line," Keel said. "Still, if it's all as lonely as this, we'll have nothing to fear but hunger."
"Let us hope," said Garrick.
Cade peeped round the corner just in time to see Garrick and Keel disappear through a doorway on the left side of the room. He looked over his shoulder, but there was no sign of Osman. Encouraged, he slipped across to the doorway, nervous and determined in equal measure. It was important that he brought something back for Aaron, some news that would prove his worth. "I did this, without you." Garrick and Keel stood in the ruins of an enormous indoor garden beneath a great dome as white and smooth as ivory. It was cut with dozens of massive windows, row upon row of them set close in a semicircle. The garden spread over many platforms and tiers, with paths winding among them. Stone channels and miniature aqueducts had once carried water between three elaborate fountains. Statues of beasts, both mythical and otherwise, waited to surprise the unwary. Glaring birds of prey, sinuous drakens, roaring bears. In days gone by, it must have been green and pleasant here, and exotic flowers had bloomed in the soil. Nothing grew now. The stones were cracked, the statues broken, the dome ruined where pieces between the windows had fallen away. Water still trickled from some unknown source, but the channels had cracked and leaked puddles onto the pathway. In the crisp, bright light of the mountains, it was a pale and mournful place. Cade was both awed by it and saddened. "Have you ever seen anything like this?" Keel asked, amazed.
"I've seen its like," said Garrick, "in Caradhis."
"You said you didn't go closer than the outskirts."
"Nor would you if you'd seen what I saw. But the outskirts were enough. The old capital. There are strange forces at work there. Time doesn't flow as it should. A man can't trust his own mind. But I saw old Ossian buildings and gardens even finer than these."
Keel tilted his head back, his eyes roaming the windows. "All they had. All they made. How did it end in barbarity and chaos?"
"Empires fall," said Garrick. "The Erds had their turn, and so did we. The Crodans style themselves as the Third Empire, but their time will come just as it did for all the others."
"Shades, don't you think of anything else?"
"Not since I lost my country."
They wandered further into the gardens, searching for an exit. Cade stayed where he was, pressed against the stone jamb. It was easy to hear their conversation in the quiet, open space.
"You need to go easy on Aaron," Keel said. "Osmond doesn't like it, Fen either. They don't understand." "They don't need to."
"They do, Garrick. You asked them to help you save him, and they did. And it cost us Otten and Dox and Tarvi and Vala. It's so hard on them to see how you hate that boy when their friends gave their lives to rescue him." Cade waited for Garrick's reply, heart bumping with the thrill of eavesdropping.
"When I look at that boy, I see his father's face," he said at length, and the words were so bitter he spat them. "And all I can think of is how I missed my chance to put a blade in that bastard's heart."
Cade went cold.
"If you ever see the Hollow Man, you run. You run and you don't stop. For he's come to kill you."
"Then tell them, eh?" said Keel. "Tell them why you risked their lives to save the son of a man you hate."
"And then what? I tell them that, I have to tell them all of it. And I won't do that. My shame is mine to keep." "Strikes me you've been letting shame set your path long enough."
Garrick rounded on him, eyes blazing, fists clenched.
"Be damned," he snarled. "You've no right to say that to me."
The Bitterbracker was uncowed.
"Who does, if not me? You need to hear it from someone." "If you want to go home to your family, just say so," Garrick snapped.
"I don't," said Keel. "I mean to say, I do, but..."
"Aye, you never could quite decide, could you?"
Garrick said spitefully. Cade saw the Bitterbracker control himself with some effort. He put up his hands as if to simmer Garrick down, but it was himself he was calming.
"All I'm saying is, there's only four of us left, and we need every one. Even then it won't be enough. We need to join up with another rebel group, bring them in on the plan. If anyone can convince them, it's you."
"There's no time,"
Garrick snarled in exasperation. "Everything is in motion. You think the royal wedding will wait for us? Ottica will marry in a matter of weeks. We have to be at Hammerholt by then."
Cade listened in bewilderment. The wedding? Hammerholt? What did that have to do with anything?
"Can't be done, Garrick," said Keel. "Not with who we've got left."
"It can,"
Garrick said through gritted teeth. "This is our only chance. Our last chance. You want another Salt Fork, and another after that? You saw how fast those spineless bastards turned on us. We'll never be free if our own people won't stand up to the Crodans. They don't believe, Keel, but we'll make them believe."
"God spit, Garrick. You're talking about breaking into the most impenetrable fortress in Ossia and snatching the Ember Blade from under the nose of the Crown Prince."
"It can be done," said Garrick with steel in his voice. "It will be."
He stalked away, leaving Keel cursing behind him. Cade pulled back from the doorway, his mind reeling. The Ember Blade? They were planning to steal the Ember Blade? He remembered how Shoal Point had been abuzz with talk of the marriage of Prince Otico to Princess Sorrel of Harrow, just before he and Aaron had been arrested. As part of the celebrations, Prince Otico would become Lord Protector of Ossia and receive the Ember Blade as a symbol of his right to rule. Dar had raged at the mere thought of a Crodan holding the Ember Blade, until Mar told him to still his flapping lips before the Iron Hand heard. But Garrick wanted to take it back. Take it back for the Ossians. A disbelieving smile spread across Cade's face. Wouldn't stealing it be a poke in the eye for the Crodans? Wouldn't that show everyone the Ossians still had some fight in them? Garrick and Keel had gone by now, but Cade didn't follow. He'd pushed his luck enough for one day. If they caught him, they might wonder what he'd heard, and now he understood Fenn's warning. Garrick might take drastic action if he thought they knew too much. He was practically hopping with excitement as he retraced his steps. With luck, Osmund would just think he'd wandered off, too curious for his own good. But what a story he'd have to tell Aaron when he awoke. He slowed and came to a stop, a frown settling on his brow. This chamber didn't look familiar. He went back a room and picked another direction, but he didn't recognize that room either. Concern became alarm as he tried room after room and recognized none of them. He hadn't strayed far from the corridor in his pursuit of Garrick and Keel, and the route had been straightforward enough. He should have been able to find his way back with ease. Yet, somehow, Cade had become completely and hopelessly lost. 37.
Nine, what have you got yourself into now?
Cade peered down another corridor, as grand as the last and just as deserted. He thought he'd been here before, but couldn't be sure. He took it anyway. It felt like the right direction to get him back to the boat, and he judged it better to go forward than to endlessly retrace his steps. As he went, he looked this way and that, searching for anything he recognized. It was no good. He might have walked this corridor twice already, and he wouldn't know it. There was something about these chill stone walls and alien curves that foiled the mind's grip. Remembering a route in Skavengard was like climbing ice. He stopped at a junction, drumming his fingers against his thigh in agitation. He remembered that room, didn't he? That frieze of symbols which ran around the walls? Maybe. Or perhaps it was another frieze in another room. His stomach rumbled. How long had he been walking now? He had a vision of wandering till he starved to death, to be found as a skeleton by the next group of travellers to brave this place. They'd imagine he met some heroic end, never suspecting he'd died of plain stupidity.
"Can't you do anything right?"
It was his Dar's voice, that tone of angry exasperation he used when Cade's ineptitude in the workshop became too much. Today he deserved it. He was furious with himself for getting lost, and if he didn't find his way out before sunset, starving might be the least of his concerns. "Paula spoke of a terror that came with the night," Vika had said. Whether rumour or fact, he didn't much want to find out. He decided to find an outside window. If he kept the lake to his left, then he'd reach the boat eventually. It was just so hard to find a straight way through. Every time he made progress, he was turned aside, led up this stair or down that passage, until he found himself travelling in a completely different direction.
"I should start shouting," he thought. "That's what Garrick said to do. The whole valley would hear me if I just shouted."
But he refused to spoil his achievement by calling for help. He was proud of himself for discovering what their rescuers were really up to. Usually Aaron thought up the plans, but this time it was Cade's plan, Cade's triumph, and he'd spin a great story from it one day. Unless, of course, it ended with him bleating like a lamb for rescue because he was too mud-headed to find his way back to the others. Besides, there was something in the silence that discouraged loud noises, something that made him want to remain unnoticed. And he wasn't looking forward to facing Garrick if he learned Cade had gone missing. It couldn't be midday yet.
He still had time to get back and give some excuse to Osman. He made his way through several chambers into a room that had been designed like a rock garden where dripping, rusted spouts hung over upright stone tubs half full of green water. This had been a place for bathing once. Now it was just a dead end. He went to the windows, which looked over the valley. At least he could see the lake from here. He put his hands on a sill and leaned out, the cold breeze blowing against his face. Skavengard stretched dizzyingly away above and below, bulging with turrets and overhanging balconies, tumbling down the cliffs to the water. He was higher up and further from the wharf than he'd thought. If he craned his head, he could see the edge of Skavengard's main island to his left, hulking into the sky. Then he noticed the shadows in the folds of the castle, longer and deeper than they should be. With a thrill of alarm, he saw that it was past midday already, long past midday. The sun was dipping in the west. Somehow time had run away from him. He could have sworn he'd been wandering for less than an hour, yet evening was creeping up fast. Suddenly the distant threat of sunset felt very close indeed. "Call for help. They'll come. Call before it's too late." No. He was still determined to do this one thing on his own. He wanted to enjoy Aaron's amazement at the news that they were not among villains, but revolutionaries, and Garrick planned to steal the Ember Blade itself. Maybe, if he and Aaron played their cards right, he'd even let them join him. Spurred by that thought, he headed back to the corridor. He had his bearings now. This time, he wouldn't go astray. This time, he was on the right track. His optimism was misplaced. Before long, he was forced out of sight of the water, and the only light came from cleverly angled shafts and windows too high to see through. He managed to descend a few levels, which was good, but worry still gnawed at him. Was the light dimming already, or was it just his imagination? He found himself wishing for the sight of another living thing, even a spider or a mouse, but there was nothing. Not a web nor a dropping, no bones or nests, no indication that anything had ever been here except the building itself. This place wasn't just dead, for death was rancid and messy. It was the eradication of life. And then, in the midst of that colossal, echoing emptiness, he heard a woman's laughter. The sound brought him to a dead stop. It had been brief and faint enough that he suspected his mind was playing tricks on him. A high, delicate sound, there and then gone. Which way had it come from? He looked through a doorway. Down there, he thought, if he'd heard it at all. A murmur of conversation blew past him, carried on a breeze from outside. Muttered speech, like two people talking on the edge of a busy room. Common sense urged caution, but anything was better than wandering this forlorn, deserted place alone. Ignoring the voices didn't seem like an option. He hurried through pillared chambers, down narrow passageways in the walls that must have been used by servants. He caught a whiff of perfume, a heady contrast to the faint scent of decay that rose from the lake and hung stagnant in Skavengard's halls. Ahead of him there was a hubbub, the clink of goblets, laughter and talk. There was even music, though it was unlike anything he'd heard before. A stringed instrument plucked tinny notes, accompanied by a strange atonal jangling and tinkling bells. "It's a party," he thought, perplexed. But not like any party he'd ever been to. His imagination filled in the scene. He pictured a glittering ballroom, highborns drifting here and there in bizarre finery, sipping exquisite wines and plotting one another's downfall beneath a bladed veil of politeness. The servant's passage dead-ended at a small door of beaten metal. Cade pressed his ear to it. The party was on the other side. A woman laughed suddenly, so close to the door that he jerked back. He hovered uncertainly in the gloomy confines of the passage. Should he make himself known? They didn't sound threatening, but it was hard to tell. At last he could stand it no longer. Cade had always preferred action over excessive thought, so he cracked open the door. There was nobody beyond. Puzzled, he pushed the door open all the way and stepped into the hall.
It was as empty as the rest of the castle. Crumbling galleries ran around the room, and sunlight slanted in from a row of windows high on one wall, shining in his eyes. Dusty mosaics sprawled across a cracked stone floor. There wasn't a soul to be seen. But he could still hear them. The sounds were all around him now. Laughter, conversation, music. They spoke in a lilting tongue like running water, frightening and wonderful. The language of old Ossia, it had to be. He closed his eyes, and it was like he was among them. Voices became louder and faded as their owners walked past him. He could smell them, their perfumes and oils, and hear the crinkle of their fabrics, the soft step of their shoes. He felt a touch on the back of his hand, a trailing finger brushing past, and his eyes jerked open again. "They're still here," he thought. "This place remembers them." Movement caught his eye, and he looked over his shoulder. With a chill of wonder, he saw the occupants of the room at last. They were cast against the wall by the light from the windows, shadows on stone. There were dozens of them, some with fantastical hairstyles or towering headdresses, others wearing large rigid hoods and robes with wide shoulders. Some drank from slender glasses and gossiped, while others moved to the music in a slow, formal dance, appearing and disappearing as they stepped in and out of the sunlit patches on the wall. The musicians themselves could be partially seen in the corner, a black tangle of limbs and long-necked instruments. Cade stared. He'd never believed in ghosts, even when he was young. They were just stories, like all the others his ma told. He was a boy who only dealt with what was in front of him, like a chisel that wouldn't do what he wanted, or his father's glowering disappointment. Ghosts were too fanciful to be part of that life. As he watched the shadow party in awe, his own shadow standing among them, he knew he'd crossed some threshold, stepped all the way into one of Ma's tales. His life as a carpenter's boy was behind him. No longer was he a prisoner, condemned to drudgery and toil. At last he was out in the world, and it was stranger and scarier and more exciting than he'd dared to dream. Were they really there, he wondered, or was this just a scene from the past played out 1,000 years ago? Before he'd really considered the wisdom of it, he opened his mouth and said, "Hello?" The music clattered into silence. All conversation ceased instantly. His greeting echoed around the hall, throbbed away down the empty corridors beyond. Then, slowly, every shadow turned its head towards him. Said Cade. He had the creeping suspicion that he'd just made a terrible mistake. And now the voices began again, this time a sinister susurrus, a vicious, hungry whispering, like the sea rushing in over a pebble beach. Though he couldn't understand the words, Cade knew they were talking about him. His skin crawled, and he took a nervous step back. The air in the room, already cold, became sharp enough for frost. The ghosts glided aside, leaving Cade's shadow standing alone where it was thrown against the wall. From the far side of the room, a new silhouette entered the hall, this one taller and somehow darker than the others. Cade felt his knees go weak as it moved from the light of one window to another, growing taller as it came towards him, a slender robed figure as elongated as a shadow at sunset, wearing a twisted crown with 7 prongs. Dread emanated from it in freezing waves, making Cade's mouth dry up and his breath grow short. He wanted to run, but he was rooted to the spot. "Ajmat Jal," he thought, "the Sorcerer King." The figure, so tall now that it had to stoop, reached out towards Cade's shadow. Sharp nailed fingers slid from voluminous sleeves, stretching across the wall, lengthening impossibly until they were almost touching his silhouette, almost. A hard, hooked nail scraped Cade's shoulder, dragging at the fabric of his coat. The touch broke his paralysis, and he screamed and bolted. He flew out of the hall, arms flailing, moving almost too fast for his feet to keep up. Stumbling and skidding, he ran headlong through the corridors and chambers of Skavengard. As he fled, he glimpsed the crowned figure again and again. There, rising in a patch of sunlight on the wall. There, sliding out of a dark corner, those terrible hands always reaching for his shadow. He sprinted round a corner, crashed into someone, and was roughly seized. Screaming and thrashing, he kicked out, and there was a grunt as his boot connected with a shin. He was grabbed and thrown violently away. His face struck a doorframe, and he went down, boneless and stunned, all the panic knocked out of him. "Cade! Cade, it's us!" It was Osman crouching next to him. Keel hopped on one foot nearby, cursing elaborately. Garrick pushed Osman aside and hauled Cade up by the front of his coat. It was he who had pulled Cade off Keel and thrown him against the door. Osman would have been gentler.
"You damn little fool," he growled, his jaw clenched. "Do you know how long we've been looking for you?"
"And we found him." Osman interposed himself quickly, for Garrick looked angry enough to strike him. "Let's be thankful for that, eh?"
"Aye," said Garrick sarcastically. "Whatever would we do if he'd been lost?"
He let Cade go, turned away and spat on the ground.
"Children."
Cade looked frantically around the room, and only began to relax when he was sure there were no shadows but their own.
"I saw him," he gasped. "Azmat Jal, I saw him."
"This place is deserted, friend. It was your own fears you saw," said Osman in calming tones. "That and nothing more."
"Get him moving, Osman," Garrick snapped. "He was supposed to be your charge. Perhaps you'll do a better job shepherding him this time. Damned if I'll go chasing after some idiot boy again."
Cade was shamefaced. Far from returning as a hero, he'd only embarrassed himself. Fenn looked at him with disdain, Osman with disappointment. Even Grubb was amused at his expense. But he'd take all of that happily, just to be back in their company. He never again wanted to be alone in this place. Cade felt a bruise already forming on his cheek where he'd hit the doorframe.
"I did see him," he muttered sulkily to Garrick's back.
"Now who the big liar?" Grubb said, and walked away cackling.
38. The first things Aaron became aware of were the crackle of the fire, the heat on his face, and a deep ache in his bones. His mouth was dry, his thoughts fuzzy, and his eyelids too heavy to open. He rolled onto his side and let out a groan. Something hot and wet slithered across his cheek, and the smell of rank, meaty breath filled his nostrils. He startled awake, eyes flying open. Inches from his face was a black, wet nose and the shaggy grey muzzle of a dog. She licked him again, right on the lips this time, and he pushed her away with a cry of disgust.
"Peace," said a low, weary voice to his right. "Ruk will not hurt you."
A woman sat there, buried beneath a cloak of stitched furs, her face swiped with black-and-white paints. She was dipping a bowl into a pot that rested on a tripod over the fire.
"Welcome back, Aaron."
Aaron looked about dazedly. He didn't recognize his surroundings at all. It was evening, and he was in a wide, empty room, packs and blankets scattered everywhere. The air was chilly and sharp and carried a faint scent of rot. Beyond the arched windows, the lower reaches of a strange island castle could be seen. He stared at its jumble of walls and angles, and fought to remember how he'd come to be here.
"Who are you?"
he asked, raising himself up on his elbows. The effort dizzied him, and he swallowed down the urge to be sick.
"Where's Cade?"
"I am Vika. Ruk, you have already met." Ruk barked happily at her name, sending another wave of reeking breath into Aaron's face. Vika pointed to the castle.
"Your friend is yonder, and will be back before long, I hope."
He heard concern in her voice.
"It is getting late."
"He left me?" Aaron was surprised to find he was hurt by that.
"He left you in my care, which is the best place you can be," said Vika.
Despite her odd appearance, she wore a smile and her eyes were kind.
Had you been in any danger, he wouldn't have done so. As it was, I believe he had some pressing purpose. No doubt he will tell you himself when he returns.
Aaron was a little reassured by that, but he still felt an uneasy sense of abandonment, left helpless and vulnerable in the company of a stranger. Ruck lurched forward and slurped his cheek again, and he fought her off.
Ruck!
At her name the hound retreated and sat on her haunches, panting.
She likes you, Vika informed him. You should be pleased. Ruck has good instincts.
Aaron wiped his face with his sleeve.
You're a druidess.
It was a statement, not a question. He'd heard enough about them to recognize her attire.
I am. Vika walks the barrows.
That's a strange name. She blew on the soup.
It is my taken name. Once I was Vika of Tanna's Fell, but no longer. When we become acolytes, we give up the names that connected us to our birthplaces, for we belong to all of Ossia. We seek our new names in visions. It is one of the first steps to becoming a druid.
Aaron winced as his head began to pound.
And what was your vision? I saw myself striding over grassy hillocks under a blood moon. Beneath my feet were the graves of kings and queens of old, and I felt them stir and mutter in their eternal sleep as I passed over them. At length, I came to a portal, an open doorway to an empty burial chamber, a barrow that was as yet unoccupied. From within, I heard a terrible voice, as of something ancient and foul. "Bring me another," it said. I did not want to do what it said, but I knew in the end I would have no choice.
Her gaze, which had become distant, sharpened again as she reached the end of her tale.
That is how I took my name.
Aaron was about to ask what it meant, but a sudden memory jerked him upright.
The Dreadknights! They are kept out by whatever lost sorcery guards the gates. We are safe for the moment. Now you should eat.
She began to get to her feet to carry him the bowl of soup, but she stopped halfway with a hiss of pain. Aaron watched as the spasm passed, and she drew herself upright and limped over to him, balancing the bowl carefully. Aaron took it and thanked her. It had only spilled a little.
Are you hurt?
He asked. She lowered herself down next to him with a rueful smile.
Merely reckless. But pain is good. I have hardly been able to feel my left arm and leg since I awoke, but I certainly feel them now.
She lifted her hand and tried to flex her fingers. The tips twitched feebly.
It seems I will recover.
She gave him a quick smile, but Aaron saw the flash of fear beneath.
Unless you won't, he thought.
Will you tell me what happened? He asked.
Eat your soup.
Aaron looked about himself.
I don't have a spoon, yes, a spoon, said Vika. My apologies. I am still not quite right.
Ruck? Ruck scampered over to her blankets, picked up a wooden spoon in her mouth and presented it eagerly to Aaron. Aaron hesitated for a moment, then decided this wasn't the time for squeamishness, or evidently hygiene, and took it. The soup was herby and rich, floating with bits of dried meat and shredded leaves. After the first spoonful, his hunger overcame his distaste for dog slobber, and he dived in. His headache began to fade, and as he ate, Vika recounted their flight to Skavengard and the battle at the gates.
You fought them? How did you beat them?
An odd look passed over Vika's face, an expression of almost childlike wonder.
I don't know, she said. I knew only that suddenly I had to oppose them, as if I was a vessel for some other will. There was light, at least I think there was light.
She trailed away.
I have met the Aspects 5 times, but never since I was 17. For the first time in many years, it felt like...
She ran out of words. Her voice faded to a whisper, and then silence. Aaron wasn't sure if it was passion or madness he saw in her eyes.
He began,
stopped and then made himself go on. I don't know your gods. I was raised by the light of the Primus. But of late I've wondered if he casts his light for Crodans alone. It felt somehow dangerous to say it. He'd been taught that it was arrogant to question the teachings of Thomas and Toven, and in some unspecified way he'd believed he or those close to him would suffer if he dared. But he'd defied the Primus in the mine at Sulla's Bluff, and he was still here. So maybe that threat had been a lie like so much else. "The aspects are your gods, too," said Vika, "whether you worship them or not. The aspects are Ossia. It was in Ossia that they first made themselves known. It was the Ossians they first freed from slavery, and from here they raised the greatest empire in the world. They are all around you, in the very bones of the land. You belong to them as they do to you." Aaron found that unsatisfyingly vague. "I suppose, I don't mean to insult you, but they always seemed so primitive." Vika smiled. "I would say old. The Crodans fashioned a new god to suit them, a cold god of industry and rules, who demands you show yourself at temple on a certain day and mouth the same words over and over. But the aspects are wild. They may heed your prayers, but they do not need your worship. Nor do they need ranks of priests and clerics to tally donations and preach to the people." She became grim then. "Perhaps that is why they are so easily forgotten. The Primus, at least, will not suffer himself to be ignored." Aaron didn't want to be drawn on the subject, but he felt compelled to argue. "Aren't druids priests of a sort?" "Not in the Crodan way. We do not instruct or threaten. We are caretakers of the land. In freer times we would visit temples when we passed, and people would gather to hear such wisdom as we had gained on our wanderings. Bards listened to what we had learned, and took our tales with them. We would heal and advise as we could. Once, kings and queens and dawn wardens consulted with the best of us." Her face darkened a little. "But we have been aloof too long, I think. And 10 years have passed since the last conclave. I fear there are few of us left." Aaron nodded to be polite, but the conversation was making him feel awkward. His belief in the Primus had been a house built of straw which had fallen at the first push. But the aspects didn't inspire him either, and the stories of the Ossian gods sounded no different to the fables of dancing fish or shape-changing maidens that Cade was so good at telling. Vika fascinated him, for he'd never met a druidess before, but she spoke with too much certainty. He found it overbearing. Fortunately, Vika changed the subject. "What is that mark on your wrist?" Aaron turned the spoon in his hand and looked, and a frown of puzzlement and alarm creased his brow. The bloody thumbprint left by Ethan had mostly flaked away during his convalescence, but there was something visible beneath. He rubbed the last of the crusted blood off to reveal a tiny red symbol hidden on the inside of his wrist. It had straight lines and regular curves, neat as a scribe's hand. He stared, amazed and not a little worried. "Asad put it there," he said weakly. "But I'm not sure how."
"Idral. Ifan is Idral."
A memory of the ragged boy sprang to mind, biting his thumb and pressing it fiercely to Aaron's wrist.
"Chled Nesan."
"I made 3 promises in that camp," said Aaron. "One to Cade, one to a pirate, and one to that Sard boy. I have to help another of his kind to repay my debt to him, but who or how he didn't say. It's some custom of their people, I think." Vika studied the mark dubiously, then took the empty bowl from him with her good hand. He was beginning to feel invigorated, as if raw, glowing health was flowing into his muscles from his stomach. "What was in that?" he asked.
"A few herbs, a few prayers," she said.
Then, with a twinkle of mischief in her eye, "a touch of the aspect's favour, perhaps." "Who'd have thought the god's favour would taste so much like soup?"
"Ha!
Let that settle, and then you can have more.
You'll be up and about soon enough. In the meantime, I would hear your story, if you'll tell me." Aaron was feeling considerably better already, and he found he wanted to talk. He'd hardly had a real conversation with anyone but Cade for months, having kept his distance from his fellow prisoners because he believed he and Cade were the only ones wrongfully incarcerated. He was ashamed of how naive he'd been. Vika listened as he began to tell his tale. He spoke of Sora and the ghost tide, and how he'd ignored her brother's warning to stay away, of his father and his talk of the Hollow Man, of that day when Randall had been arrested by Overwatchman Clisson of the Iron Hand and died on the blade of a man named Hart. There he faltered and his throat became thick and his eyes stung. Vika said nothing, merely waited until he had himself under control again. But Ruck laid her head in his lap, and he put his hand on her head. "I don't know why my father was killed," he said finally. "Was he a rebel, a collaborator? Or did he die because I was a stupid boy in love with the wrong girl?" Aaron felt tears rising again and gave up trying to hold them back. "He was afraid of Garrick, deadly afraid. But that man came to Sulla's Bluff to rescue me, and Clisson was there at the camp. I saw him, and he must have sent those dread knights after us when we escaped. It all has something to do with me, but I don't know what. I don't know what. I don't know if my father was a hero or a coward, and now I'll never be able to ask him. I'll never—" The reality of his father's absence crushed him like an avalanche, and he wept uncontrollably, his nose streaming and his shoulders shaking, gasping and snorting, a torrent of ugly, unrestrained grief. "You poor child," said Vika, and put her arms around him. He buried his head in her breast, in the furs and the softness there, the smell of old sweat and dog and earth. He clung to her as he cried for the father he'd lost and the mother he never got to hold like this, and for the rage and injustice of a lifetime deceived. Everything that he'd held back in the camp, dammed up by the need to be strong for Cade, burst out of him in one scalding flood. He cried and cried until it felt like he'd never stop. But stop he did, in the end, when he could dredge up no more sorrow. Vika kissed the top of his head, then stood and limped away to fetch wood, leaving Aaron staring into the flames, drying his sore eyes. He felt washed out and empty, and for a time he just sat there, his gaze vacant. At last he sniffed, straightened and wiped his nose with the back of his hand. "Enough," he said quietly. When Vika returned, she found him stone-faced and thoughtful. She sat on her blanket and looked towards Skavengard, scratching Ruck's scalp. Presently they heard the creak of oars as the others returned from the lake. Running footsteps clattered up the stairs, and then, "Aaron!" Cade raced across the room, dropped to his knees and hugged him so hard it drove the breath from his lungs. "You're back! You're back!" Cade cried. "Steady, you ox!" Aaron laughed. "I'm still brittle." "Nine, you gave me such a scare. I reckoned you'd gone back there. I really did. I really—" His eyes glistened with tears. "I reckoned you'd gone." "Cade?"
I just need to know one thing."
Aaron grinned. "When did you become such a blubbering sap?"